Great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Good morning, everybody. Truly a pleasure and a delight to be here with you in Lake Placid. It's also a special pleasure to listen to Rabbi Doctor. A great privilege of living near him in the Five Towns, so I have the luxury of hearing him more often, a luxury which I'm sure all of you would likewise enjoy. The topic that we are going to discuss this morning is one of the most fascinating and extraordinary topics of the 20th and 21st century. And in fact, we have a tremendous amount that we're going to cover throughout this whole conference, the conference that they really packed in with an immense amount of material. Kol hakavod to those who organized. They tell the story, actually, of a rabbi who was giving a shiur, a lecture, and in the middle of his shiur, one of his congregants left the shul. And the rabbi was very offended at the time, but he couldn't say anything in the middle of the shiur. A couple days later, he happened upon this gentleman in the streets. He said, "Sir, why did you leave my shiur?" He said, "Rabbi, I needed to take a haircut." So he said, "Why didn't you take a haircut before the shiur?" He said, "Rabbi, I didn't need a haircut before the shiur." In order for us to cover the field of medical ethics, we would have to be here till our hair would grow long. We happen to be in the middle of 3 weeks, so we're not cutting our hair anyway. And in this conference, our hair will indeed grow a little longer as we together learn some exciting aspects of the interface of medicine and halacha. So the topic today is maternity and paternity. There are many dozens of articles that deal with maternity and paternity and halacha. Our session this morning will really be highlights of some of the salient points and some of the source material which has been drawn upon in the 20th and 21st century to address some of these issues. And our lecture outline this morning is to first discuss the history of understanding of reproduction, give us a little historical context to give us an appreciation of how far we've come in our understanding of conception and human reproduction. Then we will discuss paternity and assisted reproduction and challenges to the definition of paternity, followed by a discussion of maternity and assisted reproduction, which is more complicated, and the ever-expanding challenges to the definition of maternity. The last night we mentioned in our joke about the scientists who believed he could take dirt from the ground and bring it into the laboratory. We know that indeed the original man, Adam HaRishon, was fashioned from the ground. And we have here a beautiful sculpture illustrating that. But in terms of human reproduction, the Gemara in Nida has a beautiful passage which shares with us the understanding of human reproduction. Here is that passage. Tana Rabbanan. Shlosha shutfin yesh ba'adam. There are three partners in the creation of man. HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'Aviv v'Imo. God, the father, and the mother. Aviv mazriya loven. The father emits the white seed or the white substance. Shemimenu atzamos agibim, etc., from which are derived the following list of items. Imo mazras odem. The mother emits the red substance. Shemimenu oru basar usaros, from which are derived the following list of items. Ve'akadosh Baruch Hu nosin bo ruach neshama. HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the inanimate being and invests them with the soul. Ukles der panim, uriyas ayin, takes the eyes and grants them sight, the ears and grants them hearing, the mouth, speech, the hiluch raglayim, and the legs, the power of ambulation, ubina v'seichel, the power of wisdom and understanding. Ve'kaven shi'igiyah zmano lihipoter min ha'olam, when the time comes for man to depart this world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu notel chelko, God rescinds his contribution. V'chelek avi v'imo maniach lifneihem. And the lifeless inanimate body is all that is left. What I'd like to share with you at the beginning of our discussion, we're all familiar, or at least somewhat familiar, with the basics of human reproduction as understood today. What you may not be familiar with is that in previous centuries, the understanding of human reproduction was vastly different. So, for example, we have in Parshas Ki Tazria, Daber el Hashem, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, Emor Isha Ki Tazria V'Yoldo Zachor, when a woman gives birth to a child, a male child, and it discusses the issues of purity and impurity, which we addressed very briefly last night. So the Ramban, in the 12th century, writes the following. Now, in this pasuk, the key word which many of the commentaries focus on is tazria. It says, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, a woman when she is mazria and gives birth to a male child." The root of tazria is zera, or seed. So many people in the previous centuries, many of the commentaries translated this as when a woman gives birth to a child. But, and the main issue was, does in fact a woman have a seed in the contribution to the makeup of a child? And that's the interesting historical chapter that I want to share with you briefly this morning. And the Ramban writes on this pasuk. Now, parenthetically, we know that the Rambam was a physician. Maimonides was a physician. What you may not know is that the Ramban, his rough contemporary, was also a physician. And we have, his student was the Rashba, and in the writings of the Rashba, we have a number of references that say, my teacher, the Ramban, practiced medicine in the following way. Actually, in the treatment of infertility, there's a passage. There's another passage which actually relates to Rabbi Dr. Glass' presentation, where the Ramban used a medallion with a picture of a lion to treat kidney ailment. And there was a concern, was that a form of alternative therapy back in the Middle Ages, or was that a proven form of therapy? And the Rashba attested that the Ramban, his teacher, in fact used this form of therapy. So the Ramban, in writing about this phrase, writes, the Ein Kavanah Som She'asa Avlad Mizera Ha'isha. Don't think that when the Torah writes, Isha Ki Tazria, that a woman has seed, because in fact, a woman doesn't have reproductive seed per se. Ki Isha Afal Pi She'yesh Lo Beitzim Kebeitzei Zachar, even though a woman has analogous reproductive organs to that of a male, either, and I'll paraphrase, either they don't produce a specific seed, or they are not relevant in conception. Rather, he says, the contribution of the female is the dam harechem, is the menstrual blood. And in fact, there are extensive discussions from the times of antiquity until today. Actually, I'll hold off on that for a minute. There are times, extensive discussions from antiquity until pre-modern times about what exactly the nature of the female contribution was to conception. So if you think about it from a concrete perspective and purely observational, the man's contribution to conception was known because the man emitted seed outside the body. The woman's contribution to conception was not at all known. And in fact, it was observed from times of antiquity that when a woman conceived, she would stop menstruating. So the assumption was that the menstrual blood had some relationship to the fetus. And in fact, it is Aristotle who maintained that the menstrual blood comprised the actual physical aspects of the fetus. Because after all, a woman stopped menstruating for 9 months. Where did this menstrual blood go? So it must have gone into the composition of the fetus. And some of them actually weighed blood for 9 months' worth to see if it was roughly equivalent to the weight of a fetus. And they found it was rough enough that they could attribute it to that the child was actually comprised of the menstrual blood. There are others who maintain, Galen and the likes, that in fact a woman did have a seed, but they weren't exactly sure what that seed was. Some postulated maybe the seed was the menstrual blood itself. Some postulated it was another seed. And historically, it wasn't until the 17th, early 18th century that the male reproductive seed was for the very first time visualized under the microscope by Antony von Leeuwenhoek. And this is actually, some of you may not be aware, we see our microscopes today with which we're familiar, this is the very microscope of Antony von Leeuwenhoek. And he would put the material on the tip of the needle, and this was the microscopic glass which he would view from the other side. And with this microscope, he drew what looked like the human reproductive seed. And for the very first time in human history, viewed the reproductive seed under the microscope. When he viewed the reproductive seed at that stage in history, there evolved another very interesting debate in the history of embryology. And just very briefly, the debate was whether when the child was formed, the child formed in a stepwise fashion, one organ after another, so the heart, the liver, the lung, and there was a debate about which organ came first, or whether the entire preformed human being existed within the reproductive seed and simply grew larger after it was nourished. So you have this classic picture, which is called the homunculus, where you have a little human being scrunched up within the male seed. By the way, there was even a machlokas amongst the scientists. Some believed that the entire human being was within the male reproductive seed. Some believed it was within the female reproductive seed. These were called the ovists, and these were called the spermists. And this idea is reflected, which is a contemporary notion prevalent for many centuries, is reflected in the writings of the Aruch HaShulchan, when he writes, "Kvar motzu chochmei ha-teva al pi zuchuchis megadela," scientists have seen through a microscope, that in the reproductive seed is the entire human being within that reproductive seed. And that was commonly accepted knowledge at that time, only disproved in the late 19th, the early 20th century. The human egg, by the way, we'll see in a moment, but the very first case of artificial insemination actually took place hundreds of years ago by a man named John Hunter, who had the brilliant idea for treating a couple who suffered from infertility to take the male reproductive seed and put it into a pipette, a long pipette that he fashioned, and to insert it directly into the human womb. The female contribution, the female human egg, mammalian egg, was not visualized until the 1800s, 1827, by Carl Ernst von Baer. So that gives you an idea of how far things have evolved. Moving forward into the 21st century, now every child learns in basic biology how human conception takes place, understanding the role of the male reproductive seed and the female reproductive seed. It is our control of that process of conception, which brings us to our discussion today about the challenges to paternity and maternity. So the questions that arise in these issues of assisted reproduction and paternity have to do with the following. And this is a list which I'll go through quickly. What is the halachic relevance of determining paternity or maternity of a child in treatments of infertility where you're manipulating reproduction and removing the reproductive seed from the body and either inseminating it directly or inseminating it into the laboratory, manipulating it further, and then reimplanting it into the human body? So the issues relate to the following. Mitzvot. What are the mitzvot that relate to parenthood? First of all, does the male fulfill the obligation of puravu? Kibud av v'aim, honoring your father and mother, to whom do you pay honor? Is this person who bears the child through assisted reproduction considered your legal father or your legal mother such that you have to honor them appropriately? Pidyon aben, whether you have to obligation to provide the child with a pidyon aben. Personal status, nationality, which we'll talk about more in maternity. Is the child Jewish or is the child not Jewish? Marriageability, prohibited marriages, you have certain people to whom you are forbidden to marry, so you can't marry a paternal or maternal sibling. And you have to know who that sibling is. You have to know if you're related to that individual. Is this father who produces a child through artificial insemination considered your legal father such that you are biblically prohibited to marry another sibling from that same father? Yibum, yichus, whether you are related to the father, for example, if your father is a Kohen, are you considered a Kohen, etc. And civil law, matters of inheritance and child financial support. So we'll first begin with the discussion of the fulfillment of puravu very briefly. There was a debate in the rabbinic literature about whether a child born from artificial insemination is actually legally related to the father. Now, here we have discussions even in the pre-modern times, for our discussion now in the interest of time, but and there was reasons why they were mentioning this. And the reason happened to have been bathhouse insemination was something which was documented even in the times of the Talmud. So thousands of years ago, the notion of a woman bathing in waters and becoming inseminated as a result of seed which may have been deposited there previously was a common notion in the history of antiquity, a notion which can't be readily proved or disproved, whether it's even physiologically possible. But it led the rabbis of previous generations to address these issues. So here we have the Chalkos Mechokek writing, Yesh li stapek isha shenisabra ben batya in kaim ha'av piri v'rivya. Is it indeed a fulfillment of puravu if conception takes place not as a result of normal cohabitation, normal marital relations? And here you have the Beis Shmuel bringing a proof that indeed, even though there was no direct cohabitation, no physical contact, the person who's responsible for the seed, the sperm donor, so to speak, would in fact be considered the legal father of the child. Now, in this process of artificial insemination, again, I apologize, many of these issues are much larger. Our context here is just as it relates to our discussion. But in the field of artificial insemination, when they take the reproductive seed of the man and they take the reproductive seed of the woman, there have been discussions in the modern era about the necessity for supervision of the process to ensure, in fact, that the seed that is harvested from the male is indeed the seed which is deposited either into the woman or directly deposited into the ovum, into the egg of the female. And this bears halachic relevance, obviously, to the determination of paternity as the necessity for the sperm donor of the father to be the actual person who is whose seed is used for insemination. So many do provide this process. There's a wonderful organization called PUA, which provides supervision in Eretz Yisrael and is now making inroads here and providing a supervision in the United States as well. They have a little microscopic chafke that you can put on the seed. And it has really become part of the hashgachic process. And people have joked, they said, if you're, like Dr. Glatt talked about hashgacha on vitamins and alternative medicine, if you're so concerned about the hashgacha of the things you're putting into your mouth, all the more so you should be concerned about hashgacha on your progeny, making sure that the progeny is indeed your progeny. But do mistakes ever happen? Is hashgacha necessary from a practical point? Perhaps the doctors are very particular about inseminating a woman with the seed of a male and would never make that kind of mistake. So lo and behold, and this actually, these two cases that I mentioned briefly, are only from the past year. There are a number of cases previous to these. I mention these because these are the most current. An Ohio woman is carrying another couple's child after she says a fertility clinic implanted her with the wrong embryo. 40-year-old Carolyn Savage, etc., says she knew right away and her husband would give the baby to the biological parents. Japanese woman pregnant with wrong egg after IVF mix-up. The mistake happened when the woman who was in her 20s underwent IVF treatment at a government hospital, etc., etc. So the possibility of being inseminated with the wrong reproductive seed, and these are the cases that are known and publicized. There may be cases indeed that are not factually known. There's a famous case in the Netherlands where they believe a woman was inseminated with the wrong seed because the technician neglected to wash the pipette between one insemination and another insemination. So imagine the consequences of that seemingly small act. So the question is, in this process of artificial insemination, is the person who gives the reproductive seed considered the legal father? Perhaps all these issues of kibud av v'aim, fulfillment of puravu, are not fulfilled because in fact this child is not considered the legal child. So just briefly, Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal clearly established, and that's the majority opinion today, that the sperm donor is legally, technically considered the halachic father of that child. But he was concerned about the following. In terms of paternity specifically, one of the raging halachic debates of the 70s, 60s, 70s, early 80s was if a couple was evaluated and assessed, and it was found that there was no reproductive seed in the male whatsoever that could be used for fertility treatment, could one use a donor for insemination? So this was a matter of debate. Would that constitute a form of adultery? A married woman receiving artificial seed from someone who is not her legal husband? And that was an intense debate. Moshe Feinstein was famous for his psak, that while he didn't necessarily espouse the procedure specifically, but from a technical legal perspective, he maintained that, interestingly enough, if you had a choice between using a Jewish donor and a non-Jewish donor for the process, he actually preferred a non-Jewish donor to the process. And that was for a particular legal reason, and that was the concern for consanguinity. Consanguinity means potentially marrying a sibling of yours, a paternal sibling of yours. Because if you use an insemination, a Jewish man, and that child grows up and ultimately marries somebody, could theoretically marry a paternal sibling from that same man who donated the reproductive seed. Unless you think this is vanishingly statistically impossible, there was a case reported back in the 70s in the journal Hamaor of a reproductive specialist in Be'er Sheva who was reading the newspaper one Shabbos afternoon, and he noticed the engagement of two people, and he was familiar with both the families because he personally had treated both families for infertility. And he was recalling that he didn't remember what the exact case was, but he went back to his files and he realized both families suffered from male infertility. Both required artificial insemination with a donor, and you can assume where this story is headed. He realized that both were inseminated with the very same donor. And in fact, what he was reading was an engagement of two paternal siblings to be married. And he had the daunting task of having to inform them that the paternal siblings were about to be married and to stop the marriage. And there's a similar case that transpired, not exactly in infertility, but a case of two children, twins in fact, who had been separated at birth, only learned that they were related to each other after they had become husband and wife. And this is a case that transpired in England. Now you could argue that from a sociological perspective or a psychological perspective, rather, they would have a lot to share with each other. That's perhaps why they ultimately married each other. But you'd think in this wide world, the odds of two people that were twins finding each other and marrying each other would be a virtual impossibility. You see, in fact, that it is theoretically possible, which led to the concern of Rav Moshe. So what are the challenges for paternity in the 21st century? Artificial insemination has been relatively well established. The donor is considered the legal father of the child. But what are the new horizons which are going to present themselves in our generation? So one issue which has become more prevalent in the last few years is the notion of posthumous paternity. And here you have a case from the Jerusalem Post. The Cryot Family Court ruled Sunday that a 40-year-old woman could be artificially inseminated with the sperm of a dead donor. So you have scenarios which are becoming more and more commonplace. And the context of here is a tragic case of a soldier who died. And is it possible to harvest the reproductive seed of any individual who passes away and then subsequently to implant that seed into a woman? It could be his previous spouse, it could be another woman, it could be a family member. Is that something which is welcomed in the eyes of halacha, not welcomed in the eyes of halacha? Is the father the legal father? Is the donor the legal father? So let's say you had a man who had a number of children in his life and then tragically passes away. They harvest the reproductive seed and then produce a child subsequently. Can that child then go back and claim a part of the inheritance from the other brothers? So this is really quite a fascinating and challenging issue. And Rav Mordechai Halpern wrote an essay on this, and actually just quote the next one, to give you an idea of the complexity of the matter, and again, just touching the surface here, in an article by Rav Ayal Yosef called Hafraya L'Achar Mavet, which is post-mortem insemination. He writes that L'das Agon Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal, according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, a child who's born through this process is considered legally the child, b'no shel bal hazera, the your show, and he will inherit him, even if he's born posthumously. However, ein poter mi yibum. It doesn't preclude the necessity of the woman undergoing yibum. So the law with yibum is, the Levirate marriage, that if a woman dies, if a husband dies and leaves his wife childless, that man's brother has to, in theory, marry the woman. Of course, today we don't practice that. We practice yibum instead. So he said, chalitz, I'm sorry, thank you. We practice chalitz instead. So this would, he said, with respect to yibum, that, and there's a number of legal reasons for that, that would not be sufficient. But here, the das, according to others, such a child would not be at all related, neither for inheritance nor for yibum, and according to others, it would be split even differently. So it is even possible to have partial paternity, paternity with respect to some issues in the eyes of Jewish law, but not paternity with respect to other issues in the eyes of Jewish law, which complicates the matter even further. Testicular transplants generates a new issue which has not yet been practically or clinically done, and I'll actually discuss this more in the issue of maternity. Another horizon, which is not a challenge so much in the halachic world, but a challenge in the medical world, is the preservation of fertility and preservation of the possibility of being a father, paternity, from children, young children, Rahman al-Islan, who are stricken with cancers. For someone who's older and is, God forbid, stricken with cancer, there are debates about harvesting the reproductive seed for that individual and subsequently using it if, God willing, they are cured. But if you have a child who's prepubertal, that seed, that reproductive seed, is not capable of insemination at that stage. So even if they would harvest something from the reproductive organs, it wouldn't be useful. So that is a challenge which scientists are now beginning to address with the use of stem cell research to be able to harvest from very young children and be able to cultivate that seed and ultimately be able to produce a child when God willing, that child becomes cured. And something we mentioned last night, artificial reproductive seed completely challenges the notion of maternity. So, for example, if you have a woman who takes her own stem cell from her own bone marrow, this is the extraordinary advance in modern technology. It is possible to produce from the stem cell gametes, the reproductive seed, but it's possible to produce both male reproductive seed and female reproductive seed. So you have a woman who can produce a sperm cell from her own stem cell, take her own egg, inseminate that egg, implant that egg into her womb, and give birth to a child. Now let me ask you, who is the legal father of that child? That is an immense. That's an immense challenge. So those are some of the challenges of paternity. We will now address some of the fascinating challenges in maternity, in the eyes of Jewish law. Is Rabbi Kelman here? I just want to know when I should exactly end. Okay, it's okay. Well. So here the definition of maternity in surrogate motherhood is one of the most complicated matters in the eyes of halacha. Dozens and dozens of articles have been written about this. Many poskim have been addressing these issues. I thought there was a fascinating reference, which I haven't seen quoted. Perhaps it is quoted. Others can point me to it. When Moshe Rabbeinu was arguing with God when the Jews came out of Mitzrayim, and he said, Hanofi Harisi is Kalamazed, did I conceive this nation? Imanofi Iladatiu, did I give birth to this nation that I should carry them in my bosom? So this is precisely the issue. Is it Harisi, is it the conception which defines the halachic status of the child, or is it the birth which defines the halachic status of the child? And as we mentioned before, these are some of the issues. The one which is really the major issue is nationality. So if you have a procedure whereby a woman is unable to conceive naturally, and she can use her own eggs, but is incapable of carrying the child, and needs another woman to carry the child. And if one of the partners in this process is not Jewish, what is the halachic status of that subsequent child? Is that child Jewish or is it not Jewish? And of course, to whom do you send a card on Mother's Day? Do you send it to the genetic mother or to the birth mother? Hallmark Paskins, you send it to both mothers. And we've gotten to such a ridiculous extreme where you'll see this in the Jewish personal ads. I was Reform as an embryo, conservative as a fetus, Orthodox from birth, seeking same. This is a fascinating historical precedent which we'll perhaps address maybe in our Shabbos talk. But in terms of the sources which have been marshaled, great. As far as the sources that have been marshaled, there's a whole array of sources, and this is one of the most challenging areas to find legal precedent. Because many areas, abortion, end of life, there's plenty of legal precedent. Those issues were well established. Granted, the issues have changed a little bit. But here, to anticipate that there is a genetic mother and a birth mother, those are areas that could not have theoretically been anticipated by our predecessors. To try and find legal precedent is one of the most challenging areas. So who is considered the legal mother? Some say it's the genetic mother. So, for example, we said Shlosha Shutfin Yesh Ba'adam, there are three partners in creation. So the Gemara specifically says the mother is considered the one who donates the seed, the material. There is a Medrash which talks about the Medrash of Leah and Rachel, which the Medrash talks about the fact that when Leah was pregnant, she understood that there were going to be a total of 12 tribes. And as a result, she prayed to God that the child, it was her seventh child, and it was a male child, And she was concerned that this male child would leave Rachel, her sister, giving birth to only one of the 12 tribes, and she would be inferior even to the maidservants. So she prayed that this would change. And according to the Targum Yonasan, there was an interuterine switch between the fetus of Rachel, who is a female, and the fetus of Leah, who is a male, so that Leah's prayers would be answered. And this has led the rabbinic authorities to address whether, in fact, this affects the definition of maternity, because we generally consider Dinah, who was born to Leah, to be the daughter of Leah, where in fact, according to this line of reasoning, she was not the genetic mother of Leah, she was only the birth mother of Leah. And I'll share with you just one of the agricultural precedents. One of these precedents is, if you take, according to the laws of agriculture, of Orla, if you have a tree that's less than three years old, you're not allowed to partake of that tree for the first 3 years. Only after 3 years, you bring the fourth year, you bring the fruit up to Yerushalayim, and then you can partake of the fruit. If you take a branch from a 2-year-old tree and you graft it onto a 5-year-old tree, what's the status of that fruit? Does it retain the status of the original tree, or does it receive the status of the tree onto which it's grafted? And the Gemara says in one place that it receives the status of the tree onto which it's grafted. Some use this to establish the fact that it is the birth mother, who is the recipient of the egg, who is considered the halachic mother. So what are the challenges in the 21st century? So just to conclude, the contemporary understanding, there is a massive debate and no consensus whatsoever who is considered the legal mother of the child. There is the birth mother, according to some, the genetic mother, according to others, both according to some, neither according to others. There is no general consensus, but it seems to be that the pendulum is swinging, that many of the poskim in our generation, including a letter here from Asya, are now leaning towards the notion that it is in fact the genetic mother who is considered the halachic mother of the child. You guys want to see that for a second? It's quite a bizarre. Don't worry, this is not real. So what are the challenges to the definition of maternity? We had challenges to the definition of paternity. And just in 2 minutes, I'll rapidly go through these and share each one, one moment on each one. There is not only just a contributor of the genetics, now it's possible to have two genetic contributors. You can use the cytoplasm from one mother and the DNA of another mother, the mitochondrial DNA from one mother and the chromosomal DNA from another. Do we consider then to have a mitochondrial mother in halacha in addition to a genetic mother in halacha? You can now, they're beginning research on transplantation of the human uterus. If a woman receives a uterine transplantation, is she considered a halachic mother of such a child if that transplant is successful? Ovarian transplantation is now become a reality. There have been more than a handful of cases of women who have undergone ovarian transplantation, and the most successful cases have been by Dr. Sherman Silber. Here in his first case, he had a case of identical twins who underwent ovarian transplantation. So if you have a twin who receives her own identical twin's ovary, who's considered the legal mother of that child? Because in essence, they are both derivative from the same egg. So that recipient might be not only the birth mother, she might actually, interestingly, be the genetic mother in some ways as well. And yesterday we talked about gestation in animals, and others, and we'll close with these last two slides. Other things which are challenging the definition of maternity is the possibility of gestating a fetus entirely ex utero, outside the uterus. We generally say the womb either or genetics would determine. Many of those who say it's the womb, the gestational mother, who's the halachic mother. If you're able to gestate the child completely ex utero, who would be considered the halachic child? And finally, for those of you who saw the movie Junior, the possibility of male pregnancy also looms on the horizon. And these will present the challenges to the 21st century. Just to close, there are other definitions of paternity and maternity, not only genetic and physiological, but there's also social definitions. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, "Shekolam egadol yosam b'soch beso." If someone takes a child who is orphaned and raises such a child, "Mali alav akosav ki ilu yulado." The Torah, the rabbinic teaching is that it's as if he gave birth to such a child. And kol hamalamed ben chavero Torah, even teaching someone Torah, bestows or confers upon that person a definition of paternity and maternity as well. So you see, the complexity that lies ahead is quite great. I thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And we have 2 minutes for questions. Yes.
What about Hanukkah? You have a Jewish sperm donor, and then the child is a boy. He has no idea whether or not he has any male siblings from his father. How does he? And if he dies, the child is. How does the wife ever know whether or not she needs chalitza?
How does the wife know? Again?
So
yeah.
You have a baby boy born of an artificial insemination from a male donor who is Jewish. This baby boy grows up, gets married, dies childless. The widow, does she need chalitza? Because there's no way of knowing whether or not the deceased husband had a male sibling from this donor.
I mean, if the male, if the husband was a donor to some...
You have the donor, Jewish, child is born, child grows up, gets married, dies childless.
I see.
So now, this widow married the child...
This fascinating case that you've constructed completely highlights the complexity of the matter. There's no clear resolution to this issue. These are matters of suffix. And in fact, some people say because of this continued suffix, these are reasons to prohibit the process. So you don't know. This individual, for example, wouldn't know if the donor had children from someone else. Maybe shouldn't get married to anybody because there's a possibility he might marry a sibling. Just a regular standard case of a Jewish donor who has a child, and he has his own family. So maybe that child from the donation should never get married because the possibility he might ultimately marry a sibling. And the issues of Ibn Chalitza you mentioned too. So these are precisely reasons why rabbinic authorities prohibit it. Having said that, in the case of standard artificial insemination, donation is usually anonymous. So in the general world, at least in the United States, or Moshe Feinstein Paskin, that because the majority of donors are non-Jewish, you can be so much on the fact that there is a rove. Generally, if there is a Jewish donor, it is a targeted known Jewish donor, in which case you would know who that individual is. In Eretz Yisrael, that information would be kept in perpetuity, sealed in a document not necessarily available to everybody, but available to those who would need to know that information to resolve exactly these kinds of dilemmas. Yes? Yes, sir.
So, you brought up the technological, the legal, and even the affective aspects of parenthood. And I really think that in the end, the latter dominates, even though the others have to be considered for technological and legal reasons. But, in this case, the father or the mother who brings up the child and who provides nurture and also Torah, to whom does this child ultimately have to give Kovet and Kaddish? To which one of the technological or affective parents?
That is an excellent question. The question is, to whom does a child have to say Kaddish for? There are certain aspects of halacha which are more legalistic and some which are more traditional. So the notion of saying Kaddish is sitting Shiva is a biblical issue, and that would be a question whether someone would have to sit Shiva for a parent that raised them but isn't necessarily their legal parent, because in the eyes of the law, technical law, that parent is not necessarily a legal parent to necessitate Shiva. But for things like Kaddish, those are areas which one would discuss with a rabbi, and in fact, in some of these cases, a child would be allowed to say Kaddish. And even some form of mourning process for a parent which raised them have to be discussed on a case-by-case basis. But you're absolutely correct in addressing that. Yes? So that is a question which is actually extremely relevant in the 21st century, because many of the advances that occur in the 21st century are from population studies of such donations. So, for example, the isolation of the genes that we mentioned yesterday, and even familial dysautonomia, for example, the gene for familial dysautonomia was isolated from the database of Dor Yesharim, where a number of people donated blood for the purpose of determining whether they're genetic carriers or non-genetic carriers. So to donate blood to population studies, where by virtue of studying tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people, scientists can determine commonalities, that is clearly something which is okay. You know, the risk to you as a blood donor is relatively minimal, and the potential benefit to society for the aggregate information which could be gleaned from that is great. In my opinion, that's something which doesn't rise to the level of any halachic objection. The interesting legal questions would be if they happen to take your blood sample and they found something very unique from which they created a drug. And they now, the industry is now making hundreds of millions of dollars a year from the blood sample that they took from you. So can you now claim a financial investment into that blood because it's derivative from your blood? And those are issues which remain challenging. And the patenting.